So one day, the angel adopted the disguise of a poor man and rapped at the gate, saying, "Bring me out some bread." This Rabbi Hiya couldn't resist, so he opened the door to him, whereupon the angel showed him a fiery sword and made him yield his soul. All the world is a narrow bridge, and the essential thing is not to be afraid, Rabbi Nachman said. But the fear persists nonetheless. Marlena Adler Marx writes, "Our modern world is notoriously uncomfortable about death, not for us the washing of the body, the sitting with the corpse, the acknowledgement that this end will be ours. All we've done is suppress the truth. I prefer the Hasidic way and the tales that give death the power and the majesty that it is due. Here, for example, is the 19th century story of Rabbi Lo, who tried to subvert the angel of death. One day, near Yom Kippur, the angel of death came into Rabbi Lo's town. He carried with him a long scroll on which was inscribed the names of all those members of the synagogue who were to die by plague in the coming year. The rabbi confronted the angel of death, tore the scroll from his hands, and threw the parchment into the fire. Almost every single one was saved, but one name was left on the scroll. It was his own. I have been thinking about this last story a lot lately. I have been the rabbi at my present congregation for 12 years now. I've never stayed in one place for nearly this long before, and now I am beginning to understand why. A rabbi gets very close to the members of his congregation. It is, when all is said and done, an extremely tender relationship, a love relationship, a family relationship, and I say this with a full consciousness of the many tensions and imperfections on both sides of the metaphor. In any case, when I first came here, there was a whole generation of congregants in their late 60s, 70s, and early 80s. I have buried many of these people over the past 12 years. What is worse, I have watched many of the rest grow frail and vulnerable. I have watched their skin turn pale and their spines curve and their hearing desert them. I have seen them through strokes and depressions. Not a day goes by on this job that I don't think of that cry of the heart we utter so unexpectedly during the Shema Kolenu, hear our voices prayer. Don't abandon us, God, in our old age. A cry that rises up from us precisely because we do feel abandoned then. Abandoned by God, abandoned by our community, abandoned by our bodies. The other day I did a funeral for one of these people, and there were many elderly there shoveling dirt onto the coffin. Afterward, a younger relative said to me, "I couldn't help thinking how they must have felt, how they must have thought soon it will be me." Her words went through me like a knife, because this is what I have been thinking more and more lately. More and more I have lost my immunity to the fear of death. More and more as I watch people I have come to love very deeply growing weak, bending over as if reaching for the grave and then actually dying, I feel the dirt in the grave falling on me. And like Moses and the rabbis, I find myself begging for life. I feel the fear of death intensely. I feel how even the very worst days of my life, those days when I lie there depressed and exhausted with the TV blaring mindlessly on the other side of the room, I feel how even those days are infinitely rich and infinitely precious, and I pray to God not to take them away, and I pray for the strength to make better use of them. And I felt this same feeling that day in the intensive care nursery with this perfect infant traveling so rapidly between birth and death, traversing that bridge so quickly. I looked around and tried to imagine what it must be like for his family. And I thought how we all begin this journey with a particular crew, with our primal family. Then, little by little, one by one, we are separated from them. One goes off to Chicago to marry. Another is carried away by business. Another disappears into the darkness that awaits us all. And then, there we are on the bridge alone. And in a flash of time, before we can say what has happened to us, a rabbi is reciting the vidui over our prostrate form. We are too weak to say it ourselves, already engulfed by the darkness into which we are slipping, so that the rabbi's words come to us as if through deep water. and suddenly we remember hearing his words through another watery confusion. Another sea, the sea of our chaotic infant consciousness. We are in a synagogue, being held against our father's shoulders in a pink blanket, hearing the rabbi say our real name for the first time. Or we are home. The room is full of the babble of strangers. A man is standing over us with a knife. He puts a piece of cotton daubed with wine into our mouth and we suck like crazy. It's very sweet and reassuring, but then we see the horror in our mother's face, and we feel the cold steel against our most intimate flesh, and we begin to scream. There is nothing behind us and nothing ahead except this narrow bridge, and beyond that only a great wind, that same wind the psalmist saw, that wind that will come by the moment after we have withered away like the grass, when no one will even be able to see the place where we were. Suddenly, we understand why the Great Temple of Jerusalem was an elaborate construction surrounding nothing. There, at the sacred center, at the Holy of Holies, a place we only entered on Yom Kippur, and even then only by proxy, only through the agency of the high priest, there at the center is precisely nothing. A vacated space, a charged emptiness, mirroring the charged emptiness that surrounds this world, that comes before this life and after it as well. Now we understand the deep wisdom of the poet Robinson Jeffers, who wrote, "To labor 80 years in a notch of eternity is nothing too tiresome. Enormous repose after, enormous repose before the flash of activity. Surely you never have dreamed the incredible depths were prologue and epilogue merely to the surface play in the sun, the instant of life, what is called life. I fancy that silence is the thing. This noise, a found word for it, interjection, a jump of the breath at that silence. Stars burn, grass grows, men breathe. As a man finding treasure says, ah. But the treasure's the essence. Before the man spoke, it was there, and after he has spoken, he gathers it, inexhaustible treasure." Now we understand Moses pleading for life with all his heart at the beginning of Parshat Vayelech, and then when he finally lets go, when he finally accepts that he has to die, when he finally surrenders, we understand why he turns around and says, "Well then, read my Torah every 7 years at Sukkot. Read the record of my spiritual heritage. Read what arose out of the charged emptiness at the center of my being." Now we understand why the rabbis said, "Repent one day before your death," which, of course, could be today. And we understand as well why we rehearse our death on Yom Kippur, why we say vidui and wear a kittel and refrain from eating, why in the middle of this day we send our proxy, now the cantor, into the dangerous emptiness at our center. We need a taste of this emptiness to give us a sense of what will go with us, what will endure as we make this great crossing. What's important? What is at the core of our life? What will live on after we are wind and space? What will be worthy of that endless, infinitely powerful silence? And what are we clinging to that isn't important, that won't endure, that isn't worthy? What do we want to live on? Our money, our pride, our anger, our selfishness? If not, we better let go of them now before they become what we are, what we will always be in that great emptiness for which we are bound. What lives on of the people we have loved and lost? What breaks our hearts when we think of them? What do we miss so much that it aches? Precisely that suchness, that unspeakable, ineffable, intangible quality which takes up no space at all and which never did. That's what survives that great crossing with us. That's what makes it through the passage from life to death. And we taste death on Yom Kippur to remind us of what we must hold on to and what we must let go of who we are and where we come from. We taste death on Yom Kippur to remind us that death forgives and that Yom Kippur is a little death and that they both cover over like the snow that falls at the end of James Joyce's story, The Dead. It was falling on every part of the dark central plain, on the treeless hills, falling softly upon the Bog of Allen, and farther westward, softly falling into the dark, mutinous Shannon waves. It was falling, too, upon every part of the lonely churchyard. It lay thickly drifted on the crooked headstones, on the spears of the little gate, on the barren thorns. His soul swooned slowly as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe and faintly falling, like the descent of their last end upon all the living and the dead. Turn one day before your death. One of the ironies of Jewish American life is that Yom Kippur often takes place against the backdrop of either the baseball playoffs or the World Series itself. In 1986, I had a congregation full of Mets fans in the suburbs of New York. The Mets were locked in a tense playoff with the Houston Astros, and a critical game fell on the night of Kol Nidre. We had half our usual attendance for Kol Nidre that night. It was then that I realized that baseball and Yom Kippur were competing religions. Baseball is a religion of winning. We identify with a team, and when they win, we feel a lift. We feel as if we have won. When they lose, we just don't pay very close attention. Even fans of perennial losers, a religion in itself, or those rare and true fans who appreciate loss for the depth of feeling it provokes, and for the wellsprings of compassion and affection it opens, begin with a yearning to win. Otherwise, there would be nothing to lose in the first place. Yom Kippur, on the other hand, is all about losing. Losing nobly, perhaps, but losing nevertheless. As our friends, the Buddhists, cheerfully remind us, suffering is inevitable in life. It is, in fact, life's first noble truth. Suffering is endemic to the experience of being alive. And Yom Kippur is the day when we Jews also acknowledge the truth of this. We acknowledge that we have fallen short, and we acknowledge that life has fallen short of our expectations as well. Life is a series of crushing disappointments. As Kurt Vonnegut once said, maturity is a bitter disappointment for which no remedy exists. And the fact is that as life progresses, most of us find ourselves living our lives among the mounting debris of shattered hope. There is a certain point in our lives when it becomes clear that we are not going to attain what we dreamed of attaining in our lives, or far worse, we do attain it, and it isn't what we thought it would be. We suffer broken relationships with our parents or our children. A close friendship goes bad or simply withers from distance and neglect. We suffer the death of those who are close to us and the diminishment of our own capacities through illness, or through the simple advancement of time and of age. Winning? Come on. How can we talk about winning when the overwhelming first-person biological reality of our experience as human beings is that from our 20s forward, we are unmistakably, definitively losing? Except, of course, for one small detail. There is, in fact, one human capacity that actually increases, that grows stronger and deeper as we grow older, and that is wisdom. And the reason wisdom increases as we age is that the source of all wisdom is precisely our death. As we approach death, we approach wisdom. We see this in the Torah with Moses at the moment before his death. We often read this passage just before Yom Kippur. With his death upon him, Moses is no longer afraid of it, and he has a vision beyond his own life. At the moment of death, the Torah suggests, we finally stop denying death, and when this happens, we also stop denying life. We finally see our lives for what they really are. Jacob is an even better example. His son Joseph comes to visit him as he lies dying, and he summons up his last jot of strength and tells Joseph two things. God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me, he says, and a little later he continues, and as for me, Rachel died on me along the way in the land of Canaan. Standing at the last moment of his life, Jacob is able to see it clearly and to express its meaning with great precision. The most significant moment for Jacob spiritually was the first time God appeared to him at Luz, which he then renamed Bethel, the house of God, in honor of the experience. This was the event, it was now clear to him, that had shaped his life, that had given him his mission, personally, emotionally, as for me. The most significant event in his life, he could now see, was the death of his beloved wife Rachel, whom he had to bury along the side of the road near Ephrat. In my years as a hospice chaplain, I often witnessed this kind of vision. As death approached, even the most ordinary people often acquire the ability to sum up the truth of their lives, often in a single heartbreaking sentence. I married the wrong man, and I lived without love all my life, one woman told me during the last hours of her life. I never wrote that book I always meant to write, a dying man told me. This life was a precious opportunity, and I squandered it. And at the moment of our own death, we also become capable of blessing, of seeing deeply into those we love, and giving to them from the core of our being. The deathbed blessing is a commonplace in the Torah. Isaac blesses Jacob and Esau. Moses and Jacob bless all their sons. They are able to do so because the proximity of death opens their eyes. Suddenly, they can see all the way to the core of their own essential nature and pass on the full force of their spiritual burden from there. I began to admire Mayor Giuliani of New York City about a year and a half before the events of 9/11 cast him in such a heroic light. I had never liked him much, but I began to change my mind about him during the period when he was trying to decide whether or not to run for the United States Senate. In the end, he decided not to run. Things had not been going well for him. First, there were the reports of his marital infidelity. Then came the news that he had prostate cancer and was in need of immediate treatment. Finally, he held a press conference to announce that he was withdrawing from the race. This is what he said. I have had a hard time deciding whether to run or not and deciding what kind of treatment to choose. This has never happened to me before. Until now, I have always been able to make difficult decisions when I had to, but this time I have found in thinking about it, in suffering over it, that something that is very painful and very difficult, but also very beautiful, happens to you. It makes you figure out what you're really all about and what's really important to you. It makes you figure out what should be important to you and where the core of you really exists. I guess because I've been in politics so long, I used to think the core of me was politics, but perhaps it isn't. Giuliani had always struck me as a tough, hard-charging sort of figure before this. Perhaps that was why I didn't like him very much. But here he was in his mid-50s, hesitating magnificently. All of a sudden, the possibility of death loomed before him and forced him to take a long, hard look at himself, to ask himself the most fundamental kind of questions. Who am I? What is my life really about? We Jews aren't supposed to wait for the end before we ask ourselves those questions. We are supposed to ask them all the time, and especially on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur urges us to ask them over and over again. The tradition urges us to ask them. Turn one day before your death, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi tells us in the Talmud. And we never know when that day might be, so we have to turn every day. And Rabbi Jack Reamer reminds us we are not supposed to wait for a hanging or for the doctors to pronounce that awesome word of judgment, malignant, because by then it might be too late. We are supposed to ask these questions all the time, and at least once a year, at least on this solemn day. What is my life really about? What is the truth of my life? This is why Yom Kippur is a rehearsal for our death, the day we wear a shroud and abstain from all life-affirming activities, the day we intone the funereal liturgy. Who will live and who will die? The rabbis wanted to bring us to the point of existential crisis. They wanted to bring us to the point of asking the crucial question, what is my life all about? And they knew, as Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi and Meir Giuliani knew, that few of us ask this question until it's too late. Few of us ask this question until the last moments of our life. So they have us stage a dramatic recreation of our death on this day. For my entire lifetime, the economic climate has been such that it has been fairly easy for most of us to feel as if we've been winning. But the truth is, no one wins this game. No one gets out of this one alive. The best we can do is to lose nobly, and to lose nobly means to be able to say at the end of our days that we know what our life is about. We know what's at its core. To lose nobly means to answer that question in time to move toward that core while we are still alive. The irony is, it is precisely losing, it is precisely failure and loss and death that seem to push us to the point of finally asking this question. I know a married couple who went through a major crisis. She had an affair. He was crushed and angry, of course, and the marriage seemed doomed. But as we spoke in my office, it developed that the affair was not the problem. It was merely the symptom of the problem. The problem was that the couple had fallen into a crushing deadness in their marriage. They had become careless about spending time together and rarely did, except to collapse in a stupor every evening after both of them got home from their very demanding jobs, comatose and half dead, before the TV. The affair was a failure, a horrible, unconscious act of anger, as adultery usually is. I don't recommend it. But the truth is, it also brought them back to life. The affair might have been the beginning of the end of their marriage, or it might have been the beginning of the renewal of their marriage, but the point is, it woke them up. It brought them back to the core of their being, that pulsing center of their lives from which they were estranged. The proximity of death, the ultimate failure, also seems to open us this way. In his novel, The Idiot, Fyodor Dostoevsky wrote a thinly veiled account of the time the Tsar played a terrible joke on Dostoevsky and his circle of revolutionary intellectual friends. The Tsar had them all arrested, and then one morning they were awakened at dawn and told they were to be executed. As Dostoevsky rode to the execution with his friends in an open wagon, a strange sensation began to overcome him. He felt a spacious, oceanic sense of time. He felt as if the limits of time had opened wide. In a few minutes he would die, but he felt as if he had all the time in the world to do what he needed to do. What he needed to do, he now realized, was to say goodbye to his comrades for the final time. He did this in a full and leisurely way. The great love he bore his comrades welling up to the bursting point. Then he decided to spend his last moments on Earth looking around at the world for the last time. As he did so, he found himself gazing at the tin roof of a nearby barn. A brilliant morning sun was shining, and a great burst of sunlight shone off the tin roof. Suddenly, Dostoevsky knew for a certainty that was what he would become. In a few minutes, he would die, and he would become this blazing, radiant light. This knowledge filled him with an ecstasy so intense, he thought that if it went on for even another minute, he wouldn't be able to bear it. It was then that the Tsar's captain told them it was all a joke. The Tsar had only wanted to frighten them. They wouldn't die after all. Dostoevsky was changed forever by this experience. It showed him what he was. It took him to the core of his being, and he was a different man for the rest of his life. This is what Yom Kippur asks us today. What is the core of our life? Are we living by it? Are we moving toward it? We shouldn't wait until the moment of our death to seek the answers. At the moment of death, there may be nothing we can do about it but feel regret. But if we seek the answers now, we can act in the coming year to bring ourselves closer to our core. This is the only life we have. And we all will lose it. No one gets out alive. But to lose nobly is a beautiful thing. To know the core of our being is to move beyond winning and losing. It is to enter that moment where life is deep and rich and God is present for us. We all lose, some of us nobly, and all of us with a certain amount of tragedy, but as Rabbi Zimmerman, a.k.a. Bob Dylan, reminds us, there's no success like failure. And any loss that carries us closer to the core of life is no loss at all. Silicha, forgiveness. Rabbi Shlomo Carlebach, the legendary spiritual leader and composer of Jewish music, came to the United States from Austria as a teenager, a refugee from the Nazis. Every so often, he would go back to Austria and Germany to give concerts, and people would ask him, "How can you go back there and give concerts? Don't you hate them after what they did to you? Don't you hate the Austrians and the Germans?" And this is what Shlomo would say to anyone who asked him this question. "I only have one soul. If I had two souls, I would gladly devote one of them to hating the Germans full time. But I don't. I only have one soul. And I'm not going to waste it on hating." Every year, we meet for Yom Kippur in the pall of death, not only because the Yom Kippur liturgy is so full of death, but also because it is quite striking when people die at this time. People die, of course, at all times, but when they die during the high holidays, as we are intoning the solemn liturgy, who will live and who will die, their deaths make more of an impression than usual. But one year, the pall of death was particularly heavy. Many people from my synagogue had died during and just before the holidays, and my cantor's father lay on the brink of death as well. This cantor was a very young man. At least he had been when he first came to work with me. I used to like to tease him about it. It says in the Shulchan Aruch, the great compendium of Jewish law, that the cantor who leads the congregation in prayer during the high holidays must be at least 30 years old, and that he must be married and have many children and an empty cupboard, so that when he prays on behalf of the congregation, he will pray with a broken heart. And I would tease the cantor because when he first came here, he was still in his 20s and he was single and childless, and he seemed never to have experienced a moment of significant suffering in his entire life. Then the next year he was married, and the year after that he had a child, and then he had another child, and then he turned 30. And this particular year, at Selichot services on the Saturday night before Rosh Hashanah, his heart broke in two right in the middle of the service. His father was dying, then. He would actually die around 25 hours later. The cantor and his father had been extremely close. The cantor had three sisters and no brothers, so he and his father had been the only males in the house, and they had a very deep and a very tender bond. The cantor had even chosen to follow in his father's career. He was only a part-time cantor. His father had been an eminent statistician, and the cantor had followed him into this field. At Selichot, the cantor was literally sick with concern for his father. He hadn't slept for some time, his voice was cracking, and he was emotionally distraught. And sitting right behind him, I could feel how deeply the words of the Selichot service were affecting him. But when he got to the Shmach Kolenu, "Hear Our Voices" prayer, it just became too much for him. "Hear our voice. Please listen to us, Lord our God. Do not cast us out from your presence. Do not take your Holy Spirit from us. When our strength has ebbed away, don't abandon us." This is the line that really got to the cantor, I think. His father had been a brilliant mathematician, one of the leading statisticians of his generation, and in the past few days he had been losing his mental faculties. The cantor had called him that day, and he had been speaking gibberish. So when he started chanting that line, "When our strength has ebbed away, don't abandon us," that's when he lost it. That's when he started sobbing on the altar. And when the service was over, he said to me, "You know, every year we say those words without having any idea what they mean. What are we thinking of? What do we think we're doing?" So that year, at our high holiday services, there was even more than the usual sense of how tenuous life is, more than the usual sense of what an ephemeral and precious gift this soul of ours is. We only have one soul. Why do we waste it on hatred? Why do we find it so difficult to forgive? What are we thinking of? The rabbis of the Talmud used to go to great lengths to make themselves available to grant forgiveness to the people who had wronged them. They felt they couldn't offer forgiveness until it was requested, because they were afraid to short-circuit the inner process of teshuvah. They understood that in order for forgiveness to be complete, the person who had wronged them needed to arrive at the point of a sincere apology by his or her own inner process, and they didn't want to interfere with this process. So if someone owed them an apology, they would hover around him constantly, both to remind him of what he had done and to be on hand to grant forgiveness the moment the person apologized. The rabbis recognized that forgiveness was a deep spiritual need for both parties. The wrongdoer needed to be cleansed of his wrongdoing and his guilt for it, and his victim needed to let go of the hot coal of anger he was holding on to. So the rabbis hovered around the people who had wronged them so that both these needs could be met at the earliest possible moment. I have a friend named Frank Ostaseski, who is the director of a local hospice. One of his patients was an elderly woman, a simple country kind of person. One day, not too long before she died, her brother showed up at the hospice. Her brother was a cowboy. He worked in the rodeo, traveling from town to town, and he came in wearing a big Stetson hat and a belt buckle the size of a football. He hadn't seen his sister, it turned out, for 20 or 30 years. Obviously, they weren't close. But he stayed at the hospice with her for several weeks. Their attempts at conversation were painful to listen to and never amounted to more than the merest small talk. The rest of the time, he just kind of hung out, sitting in the courtyard, smoking cigarettes and trying to stay out of people's way. One evening, Frank was just getting ready to leave the hospice, walking out the door, in fact, when suddenly the cowboy came up to him and said, "Well, I guess I got to say it sooner or later." And Frank said to himself, "Well, I better sit down because I'm not going to be leaving here anytime soon." Thus began a long conversation in which little by little and in fits and starts, this cowboy told Frank the true story of his life and his sister's life as well. They had been quite poor as small children, dirt poor, in fact. And after their mother died, their father neglected them, abused them, and then finally abandoned them altogether. They had been placed in foster homes, one nightmare after another. And during those years, he had been mean to his sister, very mean. In fact, he had abused her and hurt her very badly, and when they grew up, they drifted apart and became estranged from each other. Now that she was dying, he felt terrible about it. After this conversation, Frank took him into his sister's room and stood by him while he asked her for forgiveness. He told her that he realized that he had treated her very badly and that he was very, very sorry, and he begged her to forgive him. His sister was quiet for a while, and then, speaking with great difficulty, as she was very close to death, she said, "The people here feed me. The people here keep me clean. I'm surrounded with love. I have everything I need. There's no blame." When this big, tough cowboy with the Stetson hat and the belt buckle as big as a football heard these words, he dissolved. His face was consumed first with an infinite sadness, then with wonder and amazement, until finally it looked like the face of an innocent child. He was transformed by his sister's forgiveness. In a moment, in an instant, he had been relieved of a lifetime's pain. "There's no blame," his sister said, "because she was surrounded by love and had everything she needed, and she understood very well that she would only imprison herself if she continued to harbor anger and resentment toward her brother. She understood that anger can never produce love. Only love can produce love. Only compassion can free us from the prison of our own anger. The compassion we feel for others and the compassion we feel from them, and the compassion we feel for ourselves." And it took a great deal for her to be able to understand all that. It took the love, the sense of having her needs provided for, but also I think it took the fact that she knew she was dying and needed to free her soul from its earthly binds. I don't think she could have let go without this. Letting go of our anger and the leverage we imagine it gives us against others is one of the hardest things a human being can do. Who will live and who will die? None of us knows what will happen this year. Most of us will live, but some of us, in fact, will die. And it might be me, and it might be you. But whether we live or we die, we will only have one soul to do it with, one precious soul to inhabit for our brief moment on this mortal coil. Why have we chosen to torment this soul, to fill it with anger and hatred, to hold on to the hot coal of self-righteousness with all our might, in the foolish hope that it may someday hurt the person we imagine to be our enemy, while all the while it's only hurting us, while all the while it is our own soul, the only soul we have, that is writhing in torment? What have we been thinking of? Kapara, Atonement. Yom Kippur, or the Day of Kapara, the Day of Atonement, is about the purification of the soul. The language of the soul is paradox. Rabbi Akiva spoke this language in a famous aphorism found in the Pirkei Avot. All is foreseen, and free will is in our hands, Rabbi Akiva said. Every moment of life is the inevitable consequence of everything that has ever happened since the universe exploded into being. At the same time, we are absolutely free to respond to this inevitability, and our response will also become part of the inevitable flow of the universe. Yom Kippur begins with the Kol Nidre service, and Kol Nidre is a ritual for the nullification of vows. There is a time in life, for many of us, where the idea of the nullification of a vow is very real indeed. I am speaking about divorce. Jewish divorce is a spiritual act, and it should be no surprise, then, that this ritual also rests on a paradox. When a Jewish marriage fails, a religious divorce is absolutely necessary. The very powerful spiritual act we performed under the chuppah, the marriage canopy, that profound alteration of the universe, must be undone. Yet at the same time, it cannot be undone. Love is as strong as death, and marriage, if it contains even the slightest trace of love, lasts forever. Its consequences reverberate until the end of time. So, when a marriage fails, we must divorce in order to undo that which cannot possibly be undone. My own first wedding ceremony took place in a small Orthodox synagogue in Atlanta, Georgia. I was 22 years old. The pews were all full, and all my grandparents, now long since dead, were smiling up at me from the front row. Two rabbis presided, the rabbi of the synagogue, and the 99-year-old rabbi emeritus who had married my intended's parents. By this time, the old rabbi was quite feeble, quite frail, and his role in the ceremony was confined to the reading of the ketuvah, the wedding contract. As this was an Orthodox synagogue, he was to read the entire ketuvah, a very long document, in the original Aramaic. A few minutes into the recitation, this ancient rabbi suddenly and inexplicably fell silent. The pause grew longer, and then longer, and longer, and longer. First discomfort, and then a palpable ripple of alarm began to pass through the assembly. I looked up at the old man. He seemed to have left this plane of existence altogether. His eyes were rolled back into his skull, and his face seemed blank, empty, uninhabited by a spirit. Where had he gone? What should we do about it? No one seemed to know. The old rabbi was a figure of such veneration that no one would dare so much as jostle his arm or suggest that he get on with the ketuvah reading in some other way. Nor did anyone wish to acknowledge the horrifying possibility that a full-blown crisis might be in progress, that the rabbi might have suddenly suffered a stroke, or lost his marbles, or, for all we could tell, even died standing up right in the middle of the wedding. So we all just stood there for a long time, a measureless time out of time, an unbearably long time. Then, as abruptly as he had stopped, the rabbi started up again, picking up exactly where he had left off in the Aramaic text, without the slightest acknowledgement that anything out of the ordinary had happened. Everyone was quite relieved. I broke the glass, the dancing began, but eventually the marriage failed. Not as a result of this strange gap in the proceedings. No, I am quite sure it was the other way around. I am quite sure that there must have been some invisible flaw in the marriage which had sent the old rabbi spinning off prematurely to the next world. Over the course of time, this flaw simply made itself manifest in this dimension as well. I was still in my 20s when this flaw became so pronounced that we realized we could no longer stay together. The marriage had actually been failing for many years, but we were having a hard time finally breaking apart. We were in torment. We separated several times and then came back together again. We got a civil divorce, but that didn't seem to work either. We continued to go back and forth. We were paralyzed. Our lives were on hold. True, we had a child together, and we both loved him very much, and that certainly made the separation more difficult. But there was more to it than that. Then one morning, I woke up to a vision. I saw the old rabbi before me again, his eyes blank and rolled back, his soul off in another dimension. Then I felt precisely what it had felt like under that chuppah. It was an extraordinary feeling, a powerful feeling, the very soul of ambivalence itself. Suddenly, both the problem of my life and its solution were unmistakably clear. We had never undone the spiritual bond we had created under the chuppah. We had undone the legal bond, but that had never been our problem. Our problem was on the spiritual plane. Now we would have to get a Jewish divorce, a get. I called my first wife right away. Of course, she said. That's it. So we set about to get a Jewish divorce, and our marriage finally ended. We had been living apart, but we were finally able to separate on the spiritual level. The spiritual bond between us was severed, and we both went about our separate lives, both marrying again, this time happily and successfully. Except, of course, for the dreams I would continue to have about her for the rest of my life. Except, of course, for the times I call my present wife by my first wife's name. Except, of course, for the annoying fact that in a certain dimension, no doubt the same dimension the old rabbi visited during our wedding ceremony, we will always be married. When we marry, an indissoluble bond adheres. So why bother to divorce? We may as well ask, and especially on Yom Kippur, why bother to seek atonement for our sins? Why bother to seek kaparah? In fact, it is exactly the same question, namely, can the consequences of our behavior, good or bad, ever really be effaced, wiped away, swept clean? And the answer is, of course not. Every time the famous butterfly of uncertainty flaps its wings in China, it sets off an ineluctable chain of events. Hurricanes, tornadoes, the reformation of the continents, and so on and so forth, until the end of time. No action can ever be undone, nor its consequences ever effaced. So why do we fast all day on Yom Kippur? Why do we submit ourselves to this yearly ritual of self-abnegation? Why even bother to ask anyone for forgiveness? Kaparah, the Hebrew word for atonement, means a covering over. The idea is not that atonement effaces our sins. It cannot. They will always be there, along with everything else we and everyone else has ever done, an endless and indissoluble concatenation of cause and effect, stretching back to the beginning of time and reaching forward to its end as well. When we make atonement, kaparah, we are covering over our wrongdoing with the will to behave differently. While this does not efface our previous behavior, it may, in fact, redeem it. More important, it allows us to move on and let go of the past. Our behavior is still out there and will always be, but we are no longer attached to it. We no longer need to feel guilty or angry about it. We no longer need to feel as if we have failed. The original act may even still adhere to us, but we no longer claim ownership of it. we have covered that over with a fresh act of will. I try my best to be a good rabbi, but I'm working with very limited equipment, and sometimes I let people down. Someone who had read my first book once told me that while they enjoyed reading it very much, they thought the book might have been too honest. They thought it really made me look like a schlamazel, that classic figure of Jewish literature who was the constant victim of bad luck and his own remedial bungling. He wondered what some congregants would think about having such a schlamazel for a rabbi. A lot of people want their rabbi to be a father, like Robert Young in Father Knows Best, or if not actually God, at least a stand-in for God. And I know a lot of rabbis who spend their whole life's energy pretending to be these things. I don't have that kind of energy. I try to make the best of what I have by offering up my schlamazelhood to others in the hope that this may illuminate their own inner schlamazel and help them come to terms with it. Maybe then they won't have to spend so much of their life's energy defending against the truth of their own lives. But I am a schlamazel, and sometimes I let people down. Sometimes I let them down because it just can't be helped. Sometimes I just can't get to them. I find myself doing triage all the time, and sometimes I let people down because there might be a dozen more pressing concerns that stand between their need and my ability to reach them. But sometimes I let people down because I simply blow it. I don't do what I'm supposed to do for one reason or another, or for no reason whatsoever that I am able to fathom. I just fail. And sometimes the consequences of my failure can be quite serious. There is a young couple in my congregation I like very well. I admire them. I converted the woman, and I married them several years ago. It was a beautiful wedding, too, at a lovely winery up in Sonoma County, a day like all wedding days, full of hope and fond dreams. But then they had a horrible tragedy. The child they had been expecting was born dead, and the mother had a perilous time of it herself for a while. Her husband called me a few days after this had all taken place. It so happened I had the flu at the time he called. I told him I didn't want to come to the hospital just then because I was afraid I would make his wife sick, but I promised to come in a few days when I was better. But you know what? I never went. I still don't know what happened. I simply don't remember. Maybe in my weakened condition I just didn't want to face such a painful situation, or maybe there was just too much on my plate. Phone calls, meetings, and people trooping in and out of my office in various states of distress, and I just couldn't keep track of it all. Or maybe my memory was failing, or maybe I really was just a callous SOB who only pretended to care about people. In any case, for one reason or another, I forgot all about this couple and their terrible tragedy. I recovered from my flu a few days later, and the whole thing, as serious, as grave as it was, the whole thing just slipped through my mind. It just fell through the cracks, and I never even thought about it again until months later when I learned this couple had left the synagogue in disgust, hurt, and in great pain. They were devastated by my not showing up, crushed. The husband told me it was the biggest religious disappointment of his life. I called them up to apologize, and of course they accepted my apology and forgave me. They are very fine people. But believe me, this is written in the book of my life. It is written indelibly, and it's sealed as well. I could ask them for forgiveness, but I couldn't ask them to undo what had happened. No one could do that. Nor could anyone undo the hurt they experienced or the disillusionment of the young woman. I had converted her to Judaism. And, most significantly, from my point of view, no one could change this judgment of who I really was. "Your feet take you to where you really want to go," the young man told me when I called him to apologize. And I knew he was right. I might think of myself as a great compassionate healer. I might think of myself as a caring, giving person, always there for people when they need me. I might tell story after story, casting myself in this role. But this was the unavoidable truth of my life. This was what was written in the book of my life. This is where my feet had taken me, or more precisely, where they had failed to take me. So why even bother to ask for forgiveness? Why make kapara? That behavior needs to be covered over precisely because it will always be out there. Their hurt needed to be covered over. It was like an exposed wound, an open sore, and it needed to be covered over by an acknowledgement that they had been hurt, by a validation of what they had experienced, by a corroboration from me that I had hurt them. Then they could begin to heal from it, or at least from the part I was responsible for. They could then begin to let go of it. And I needed to cover this act of thoughtlessness over with a new resolve. It will always be out there. It will always be part of the story of who I am, only a part, to be sure. There have been many occasions when I was there for people. More than once I have gotten out of bed in the middle of the night to go sit with strangers at the hospital, but that's the part of the story I like to tell. Now there's another part, a part I don't want to look at so much. Only by responding differently when this sort of thing happens in the future can I cover it over with another story, one that might change its meaning yet again. This is why atonement is like divorce. Our marriages never leave us. They cling to us in our dreams and in the names we call up from our unconscious. But the ritual of divorce covers them over with a fresh act of will. And this act will create a flow of consequences that covers over the old one. Every once in a while, maybe just a few times in life, you can feel the force of this, the flow of consequences that has brought you to the present moment of your life. You can actually experience a moment as the product of the totality of all creation. I had such a moment some years ago. I was visiting a man who was both mentally challenged and exceedingly small, a dwarf, in fact, in a halfway house up on Diamond Height in San Francisco. He was in immense emotional pain. Whenever we sat together, he would ask me questions like, "How come God didn't let me grow? Why won't God take me?" These were questions I could never answer, of course. Then one day I was ushered into the living room of the halfway house to see him, and there he was. He had just put a Beatles record on the old phonograph they had there, and "She Came In Through the Bathroom Window" was blasting all over the house, and he was singing along at the top of his lungs and dancing across the living room floor with a heartbreaking, wholehearted passion and joy. Behind him, as he danced, was a great panoramic view. The bay, the Oakland Hills, the downtown skyscape. And as I walked in upon this scene, the enormity of what had produced it suddenly struck me. Think of what went into this moment. Start anywhere. Start, for example, with the entire cultural history of Western civilization, a culture that twisted and turned for more than 2,000 years just so the Beatles could come tumbling out in the end. Or start with the technology of the phonograph record. Or start with the geological upheavals of the Western Americas, which produced this beautiful city, these hills, this breathtaking bay. Or start with the psychology and the physiology of the man himself, the immensity of his suffering, and the mysterious spiritual mechanism that transformed that suffering into song and dance. She came in through the bathroom window. All of it absolutely necessary, absolutely inevitable, absolutely indispensable to this explosion of pure joy, this big ecstatic bang. There hasn't been enough time since the beginning of all creation for all of this to have happened by accident. This moment had been hammered into place by the totality of creation. And stretching before us from this moment are the infinite consequences of our present action. From here, we will a kapara. We let go of the pain of the past. We cover it over with a new intention. And then that intention ripples out soul to soul until it has filled all of time. We say, "We have been married from time past until now, and that will never go away. But now I cover that over. I release you. I send you away. I put you aside." We say, "I have sinned. I have transgressed. I have done wrong. I have done something terribly hurtful." And we say precisely what it is. We read the book we don't want to read. I have done this, and I have done that, and I acknowledge it is irreversible, it can never be undone, but I cover it over now. I resolve to begin anew. Now there is something new in the world, a new possibility. The universe is forever changed, just as we changed it under the chuppah that day when the Ancient One seemed to be elsewhere, but then finally returned. The Haftarah. Isaiah laughs at us. According to the Kabbalah, before creation, God existed in a primordial state known alternatively as the Ein Sof, the endlessness, and the Ayin, the emptiness. But this endless emptiness was such a powerfully charged state that nothing could withstand it. Nothing could coexist in its presence. So in order to create the universe, the Ein Sof had to perform an operation known as Tzimtzum. It contracted itself, removing itself from a tiny speck at the center of its vast emptiness. This tiny speck was creation, the universe. But in the middle of this Tzimtzum, this divine contraction, a cosmic catastrophe occurred. The Kabbalists call this catastrophe Shvirat HaKelim, the breaking of the vessels. The divine light was being hauled away from this tiny speck at the center of the Ein Sof in vessels, but the light was too strong for the vessels, and the vessels broke. And the divine light was scattered all over the universe, throwing the world into chaos, creating a broken and dangerous world. The purpose of human existence, according to the Kabbalah, is Tikkun Olam, repairing the universe, fixing the vessels, recapturing the divine light. Everything we can do to correct the brokenness of the world accomplishes this. Spiritual activity accomplishes this, and so does the pursuit of social justice in the world. Yet, in a thoroughly broken world, when we carry our own spiritual brokenness into every endeavor, how can we expect to be the agents of real repair? How can we prevent our own brokenness from defeating every attempt we make to repair the world? Kabir, the medieval Sufi poet, writes, I talk to my inner lover and I say, why such a rush? We sense that there is some sort of spirit that loves birds and animals and the ants, perhaps the same one who gave a radiance to you in your mother's womb. Is it logical you would be walking around entirely orphaned now? The truth is you turned away yourself and decided to go into the dark alone. Now you're tangled up in others and have forgotten what you once knew. And that's why everything you do has some weird failure in it. So, according to Kabir, this weird failure, this brokenness of the world, comes from our having turned away to enter the dark alone. The Haftarah, the special reading from the prophets, which accompanies every Sabbath and festival service, we read in the middle of the Yom Kippur service, also speaks of a radiance and a movement from the darkness to the light. This is my favorite liturgical moment of the year. It is Yom Kippur morning, and we are feeling quite pious, quite proud of ourselves for having fasted all the way from dinner last night to the present moment. Our growling stomach reinforces this feeling. We congratulate ourselves for great sincerity with each fresh pang. Then all of a sudden we hear the voice of God through the medium of the prophet Isaiah mocking us, taunting us. Is this the fast I have chosen? Is this your affliction of the soul? Is it to droop your head like a bulrush, to grovel in sackcloth and ashes? Is this what you call fasting? A fast that the Lord would accept? Is not this my chosen fast? Loosen all the bonds that bind men unfairly. Let the oppressed go free. Break every yoke. Share your bread with the hungry. Take the homeless into your home. Clothe the naked when you see him. Do not turn away from people in need. Then cleansing light shall break forth like the dawn, and your wounds shall soon be healed. Isaiah is telling how we might turn away from our own darkness, from the place where everything has some weird failure to it. When we feed the hungry, when we house the homeless, when we care for those in need, we move toward the light. This is advice we almost always need to hear. The stock market goes up and the stock market goes down. We feel